This is Dana Bennett with the Nevada Legislature Oral History Project. It is Monday, December 1st, 2008, at about 2 p.m. This afternoon, I'm speaking with John Marvel in the Legislative Building in Carson City, Nevada. Mr. Marvel served in the Nevada Assembly from 1978 to 2008. He was Assembly Minority Leader in 1993.
All right, ready.
Good afternoon, Assemblyman Marvel.
Good to have you with us, Dana. After I miss you on LCB, it's always a pleasure to have you with us.
Thank you very much. I think I'm going to enjoy our conversation today.
So am I. I've been looking forward to this. I'm glad I'm out of the hospital so we can have this get together.
Yeah, I'm glad.
And it's nice to have Gwen here too, because I've known her from the past.
Yep. Well, good. I think it's going to be fun. Let's start out at your first day of your first opening session. Let's imagine that it's January 15th, 1979. You've been newly elected to the Assembly. What were you thinking?
Then I'll tell you what, it wasn't my first time experience being exposed to a legislative process, because I had been a chairman of the Nevada Tax Commission and also was president of the Nevada Cattlemen Association. So we spend quite a little time at the legislature attending hearings and whatnot. So you knew how the process worked. And the reason I kind of got into politics was the fact that I had people in my district, like Senator Dean Rhodes now, who at that time was Assemblyman, and of course Senator Norman Glaser, who represented rural Nevada, that more or less asked me if I would run. That was, of course, after Bode Howard had unfortunately passed away here during a session. So they asked me if I'd be interested in running, so I just said, well, since I've had kind of a background with legislative process, I'd probably had nothing to lose by trying it. So we decided to get into it.
And how big was your district the first time?
Well, the first time I ran, I had all Lander County, all of Humboldt County, all of Pershing County. And then they split Lander County up later, reapportionment. But before this last reapportionment, I had probably the best district you could possibly have. That was half of Lander County, all of Humboldt County, all of Pershing County, big part of Eureka County, and about a third of Elko County. So it was a a commonality type of a district. You know, we were on the Humboldt River, we were on I-80, and everybody had similar problems. So it was a much easier, you might say, area to represent, because, you know, people all thought pretty much the same. It was in my book, of course, I've always prided myself on being a rural legislator. And I wasn't very happy when I was thrown into the urban area, like the city of Sparks, because unfortunately overnight, most of my constituency was, or about 80% of my constituency was in an urban area. And I knew it, you know, from the very get-go that it was going to be difficult to ever win in Sparks, for people really didn't know me, and where you didn't actually live in that area. And so you didn't really have that exposure. And I tried to explain that to the governor, but it kind of fell on deaf ears.
Let's talk about your first campaign. How did you run for office that first time?
Well, the first time was pretty easy, because you know, you didn't have so much TV to work with. It was mostly a personal contact. And of course, at that time, I'd had a lot of exposure. We'd just been through the Sagebrush Rebellion. So I was in most of rural Nevada all the time. That was, of course, when I was president of the Cattlemen Association, so I had a lot of name recognition. And we came through with some mailers, but I would say mostly it was a contact, a little house-to-house. Matter of fact, my wife was probably the best campaigner of all, because she was the one that did all the house to house until the dogs kind of scared her off.
Well, that's a lot of territory. How did you do house to house? No, we
were very selective where we went. Like Winnemuck, of course, was the hub of the voting public, and so we spent more time probably doing the house to house in Winnemuck. And of course, I'd been pretty well known in Winnemuck area for years. Winnemuck is kind of one of the main shopping areas for Battle Mountain, and of course, I've been in the ranching business. I bought most of my equipment in the Winnemucca area. Mm-hmm. And so we were pretty well familiar with, and people were familiar with us. So it wasn't a matter of people having to learn who I was. It was just a matter of whether they felt I was capable of being representing them.
You had lived in that area your entire life.
I was born in Battle Mountain, perhaps one of the last babies ever born at home. And
you were born at home?
I was born at home. And of course, it was kind of sad. I think it was very difficult for my mother. But after that, most babies were born in the hospital. But for some reason, she decided that I would be born at home.
And that was out on the ranch?
No, we lived in town.
Oh, you lived in town?
No, we had a one time. So we had a kind of a large outfit sheep and cattle. And Battlemont was kind of the focal point because our sheep used to run in the wintertime down around Fallon, and in the summertime they'd go as far north as Idaho. And so Battlemont was kind of central part between the summer range and the winter range. And of course, we were on the Western Pacific Railroad, and we had a big shearing plant on the Western Pacific. So when the sheep came through, we would shear them. And we had a big loading dock right off the railroad spur, and that's where we loaded our wool. And of course, there was several thousand pounds of wool every year when you have 18,000 head of ewes.
So when you were growing up, did you know any of the legislators that represented your area?
Well, you knew people like Bill Swackhammer. He was he'd been an assemblyman for years. And of course, then reapportionment got him too, and he eventually became Secretary of State. But then what we knew was Snowy Monroe. You know, in those days, you knew everybody. You know, Nevada was still just kind of pretty much a rural area. And so you knew everyone.
So after you'd won your campaign and you were somewhat familiar with the legislature, when you showed up here as an assemblyman, what surprised you the most?
You know, I don't think I was surprised by anything. I think the only thing you had to learn was, one of the bills that I got that was my idea was getting rid of the inventory tax. Well, unfortunately, I made a mistake of telling Norman Glazer about what I intended to do. Well, he introduced the bill before I had a chance to. And it turned out to be, it was a great bill for merchants and for people that had to declare their inventory every year, and just took a lot of burden off of our shopkeepers. And of course, we were able to get cattle and sheep off the inventory, so you didn't have to go out and inventory your merchandise every year.
So when you came here, you had some ideas of legislation?
We had some ideas about how it should work. And of course, my experience being on the tax commission was a big help. I'd been on it for 5 years and ended up being chairman when Paul Laxalt was governor. So that really gave me, a leg up as far as knowing the tax end of it.
Looking at the bills that you introduced, it seemed like most of them were about tax.
They were. I felt, very comfortable and very familiar with taxation problems and issues.
How did you learn the legislative process? Was there anyone who helped you?
It's by attrition, I think. like anything else, it's kind of hands-on. There's a lot of things. Then the big thing is you learn to work with people, and you learn the people that you can trust. You learn the people you got to keep, arm's length with, and so. But it was just a good relationship, right? When I had friends, on both sides of the aisle, and I would be very candid with you and say that when I was first elected, we probably had more support from our Las Vegas people than we did from Northern Nevada, because at that time it was before when Washoe County really, you might say, it was the dominant part or area. In Nevada, that was before the power shift went south. But I had just an awful lot of help from our Las Vegas people. And so I was very fortunate during my legislative career. About every bill I introduced, I was able to get passed. And I've only been in the majority once and a half. The half was in 1995 when we had a tie house. And so we co-chaired all the committees, and we had co-speakers. And I think probably turned out to be one of the smoothest, I would say, of sessions that I've ever spent, of all the sessions I spent in the legislature. And we had more people that were complimentary about how smooth the session went.
Well, you co-chaired Ways and Means that session.
No, right. I'd been chairman of Ways and Means before. But I ended up being the ranking member on Ways and Means. Of course, I was the ranking member in the assembly.
So tell me how that worked in terms of your relationship with the various chairs of Ways and Means over the years.
Oh, yeah, I've had really good rapport with all the chairs. This is one of the things you learn, in the legislature is you make friends, you don't make enemies. What you do, and you respect other people too. Now, there's some, you realize the Democrats are Democrat, Republicans are Republican, and we have probably different philosophical ideas. But at the same time, you can disagree, but you can still get along. And I probably have just as many Democrat friends as I did Republican friends. And I think the secret to being a decent legislator is to make sure that you're there as a person. I've always told people this, and particularly as chairman of a committee, I said, make sure, remember this, that the person that's testifying, or even one of us, as a man, you put your trousers on one leg at a time, and none of us change.
Who Who are some of those people who stand out in your memory that you've worked with over the years?
I think probably one of the greatest people was Jim Gibson, who was chairman of Senate Finance. And he was chairman of Senate Finance, and I was chairman of Ways and Means. And we'd had some, he'd really had some rather cantankerous times with some of the previous chairmen we've had. And, you know, he didn't see quite eye to eye with them. So one of the nicest compliments he gave me was, Johnny says, you're having me over there is like having a breath of fresh air. He said, I have somebody now I can work with. And so Jim and I did have a great relationship. And of course, Bill Raggio, he's been great to work with. And I think like Lynn Hetrick, and I understand you've done a history on Lynn. And Lynn, of course, he was super intelligent and just did a fantastic job. But you look back over the years, and I've shared with great legends, like Roger Bremner. He was chairman of Ways and Means, and of course, he's still involved in state government. And it's hard, you know, just right off the top of my head to go back through, you know, like even with Nick Horn. You know, Nick and I worked together on cultural resources, and we were both together with on prison industries. So Nick, before Nick's demise, he and I worked very closely on cultural resources, and we were able to get legislation through so that we were able to get the bond issue passed that we were able to preserve many of our cultural resources. And it's a $2 million bond every 2 years, and people have never objected to it. It's done just a tremendous lot of good in preserving our cultural resources in the state of Nevada. And of course, Nick and I have worked very closely on prison industries, and it's one of the positive things you can say about prisons, that we do take these people, give them some a gainful occupation, and a lot of the people we can train when they go out in the street, that they have a worthwhile occupation, plus the fact that we've collected millions of dollars in room and board and victims of crime, and a certain portion of it goes to capital improvements for any industry program. So it's been one of the most successful things I've seen from a negative to a positive.
Yeah, that's a program you worked with
since 1985. I've been on the committee since 1987. I've been chairman of it for the last six or seven sessions.
What was it that sparked your interest in that particular project in the beginning?
I'll tell you, I've always been interested in prisons because I was on the site selection committee back in 1985 when we had to build prisons for the state of Nevada. So we traveled around the United States looking at prisons, looking at prison industries, and then we had to locate sites in Nevada. But we had an agreement at the time that Clark County at that time did not want any prisons. And Washoe County said they didn't want any either, but if we were desperate for a site, that they would take a look at it and see if we could. But you know, at the time we were thinking that we'd like to help the rural Nevada by siting some of the prisons like, say, in Lovelock with Pershing County, and of course Ely, because Ely got a bad rap in 1979, when they were promised a prison and it was jerked out from under them. And we realized that, you know, there was going to be some logistic problems for both places until you finally got the staff settled where you were getting people that would stay in the system. But we realized it was going to be difficult in staffing for the first few years, but that's, you know, I've been involved in prison since my whole legislative career, you might say.
Yeah, and when you look at your bill introduction.
When I go by Lovelock, I say there's Marvel Manor.
Did you have a particular philosophy in deciding what to introduce as a bill?
Oh, no. I think what you really do to anyone when you look at that bill, it's not so philosophical as a need. And you have to look back and recount, you know, things like the cultural resources. There were things like I had in Winnemucca, we had the Nixon Hall. And that was, I can remember when I was a kid, we had people like Will Rogers used to show up during the Labor Day festivities. Well, here we had something that, you know, that had some real historical significance, and that's one of the reasons I really got involved in it. And of course, there have been places like the Fourth Ward School in Virginia City and all kinds of areas in the state of Nevada that they were worthy of restoration. And that's one of the reasons I got involved, because, you know, being a native Nevada and getting up in years, you kind of, the older you get, the more you appreciate it. And that's one of the reasons I think that I've been involved in that aspect of the legislation.
Was that a difficult bill to get through?
No, it really wasn't. It was a bill, I think, when people saw the merits of it, and you were able to show them, you know, the good it would do. And I think we really had good support for it. It was like anything else, so, you know, anytime you're spending money, people are going to question it, but it was a bond issue, and so it's repaid itself many times over.
What was the toughest issue that you can remember working on?
Oh, I think budgets are always tough. Mm-hmm. And I'm being a senior member on Ways and Means. You know, every session is different. Some sessions, you know, we like 83 was tough, 93 was tough. Didn't have much money. We've had some bountiful years. When there's the hardest part in a bountiful year is the fact of saying no when there's money. And the good thing about the lean years is the fact you just say no and they understand that every part of what the word no means. But sometimes during when you have surplus years, people don't understand the word no. But you got to be careful that you don't create programs that you can't, you got to keep funding perpetually. So you got to be very, very careful, and that's one reason we have to be very careful with the federal money that we receive. So we don't build programs, and eventually when the feds pull their money out, that the state of Nevada isn't going to be strapped with a program we can't afford. So this has always been one of the conditions that when the federal money disappears, the positions disappear.
Tell me a little bit about the tax shift in 81 and 82.
Well, everybody calls it the shaft or shift, but at that time...
Your attention, please. The assembly is about to convene.
All right, before you start.
Okay, rolling.
We were talking about the budget.
Well, as I say, we've been through quite a few budget cycles, good and bad. This is repetition, but let's say in the good years, it's really tough because everybody wants money. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and you realize that when I was talking about also the federal money, that when you get federal money and they want to add staff to be able to spend or to be able to implement the federal grants, you got to make sure the condition is that the positions they hire are only there as long as the federal money stays. And they don't build a program the state has to pick up eventually. So there has to be a very concise understanding that program goes away even the federal money goes away.
So over the years, you had to say no more often than you had to say yes?
Well, I think it's been about a 50-50 deal. And of course, in times like this, what you have to do, you just freeze every position and you don't fill them. And, you know, hopefully you don't have to have layoffs. And, you know, it's tough. When these people have families, and of course, there's a lot of good benefits out there for people in state government, and you hate to cut them off and leave them in the lurch, mm-hmm. because it's difficult or hard on their families. But at the same time, even if they'd have to take maybe a reduction, as long as you maintain their benefits, that's a lot better than laying them off entirely. So we'll see what the special session comes up with.
Yeah. Tell me about tax policy and how that changed over your years.
Oh, yeah, we're going to start on that. The tax shaft. Well, I was part of the tax shift. But at the time, you know, we used to have, the state of Nevada used to take 36 cents on the rate of every tax dollar.
Property tax rate?
Yeah, of property taxes. And so it was our opinion at the time, with the consensus of most legislators, that the state should get out of the ad valorem. And we should let that go then to the counties and to the schools. Mm-hmm. So the state, because we used to take 25 cents plus 11 cents for indigent care. So we got out of that completely. So we gave the counties and local governments and the school district what the state was taking. And hopefully, it was going to help cure a lot of their fiscal problems too by giving that extra money for them from the ad valorem tax. And I think it was a benefit for a long time. Of course, then over the years, the sales taxes kind of crept up, and we've had BBC, RT, and we've had local school support tax that comes out of the sales tax, and that's exactly how you fund, that's your local support, like say for schools. And of course, one of the reasons I hate to see a local economy get bad is the fact that with that local support, that means that less dependency there is on the state general fund to support the distributed school account. But when local money goes away, then the state has that responsibility to come up with the distributed school money. And so that probably is what's happening right now in most of our counties. The only counties I think they're probably in good shape yet are, say, Humboldt, Lander, and Elkhorn County, where we have good mining conditions and property values haven't decreased. And that's the reason I really have to be honest with you. I know it doesn't sound like a conservative, but this reason I hate these tax caps, because I think what happens, it limits it really limits the scope of local government and school districts of being able to fund what they really need. Because these caps are just difficult to work around. And I think, you know, that's why you elect people to your county governments, where you elect school boards. But you're looking for people, you know, that have some kind of fiscal responsibility. And I don't think that they're going to go out and just spend money like it very wantonly. But the caps really, I think they get in their way.
Is there something, particularly looking at it back from our perspective in this difficult year, was there something during that, you know, what's known as the tax shift that perhaps should have been done a little bit differently, or?
Well, you know, I don't, I you know, everybody's talking about re-examining where we are, but what do you re-examine? If you start taking money away from the counties, who's going to take care of them? And that is one the speaker keeps talking about. We're going to have to re-examine our sources of taxation. Well, if you start dipping in what the counties are receiving right now, who's going to bail them out? And you know, whatever it is, we take away from the schools, we still have, you know, a constitutional provision that we have to provide for school funding, whether to like it or not. Otherwise, we're going to be in court so quick you can't, you know, that is a federal responsibility, and the Supreme Court's already ruled on it, that you got to treat all students alike. And so Nevada will have that responsibility. So you got to be real careful. You don't rob Peter to pay Paul.
So let's think back to the first couple of years you were in the assembly. What was a regular day like in the legislature, particularly being a member of the minority party?
Up until by 83, it was just kind of, you know, business as usual. You got the bills through, you had the hearings, and there was really nothing too contentious. And at that time, you know, there wasn't any partisan politics. And I didn't see too many people that were getting ambitious to go other places. Most people just wanted to get the business of state done. And I think as time progressed, you saw more people that decided maybe they wanted to be a United States senator or a congressman, and they had their own agendas. But I've had a good relationship even right until now with most of our legislators, but you see, you know, you can see what's happening, and it's difficult for me, who have primarily coming from rural Nevada, to see the power shift all go to Clark County. And after this last election, that's precisely where it's gone. We only have one senator from the north, as you can see, and the bulk of your power committees are from the south. And just hopefully, but you know, of course, we still have people like Bill Raggio and people like that that still command a lot of respect, but you know, it's not like it was. So I would say the session this coming up is not going to be a very pleasant one.
It's really looking tough, that's for sure.
It's tough.
Yeah. Well, you've talked about some of the legislators that you've worked with over the years. Who are some of the lobbyists?
Well, I think, you know, when it goes right back down to it, I don't know if you knew him or not, but probably one of the prime lobbyists in my book was Jim Joyce. There was a man that came to you, one of the most honorable people I've ever worked with. And he'd come to you and he'd tell you this, who he represented. He'd say, I this is why I represent, and this is my point of view. He said, now I know what's on the other side. He said, so it's up to you to make up your mind. He said, I'm not going to lie to you, I'll tell you the truth. So Jim, I think, probably set the standard for most lobbyists. But I think, by and large, most lobbyists have been really great to work with. I've had guys like they will say they've got crazy, the John Sandys, and you know, just to go down the list and name a bunch, they've all been excellent people to work with.
What do you think? What's the mark of a good lobbyist from a legislator's perspective?
Truthfulness. As long as they don't tell you a lie, and you can trust them, then you listen to their story. But if one of them lies to you, you'll never ever have any regard for them. Matter of fact, some of them you won't even let in your office.
And did that happen over the years?
Oh, I think I told my secretary that if so-and-so wanted to come in, that I was busy. I won't name names, but I don't think that'd be proper.
Did you hear much from your constituents?
You know, you'd get phone calls. And I like the phone, but I like the one-on-one. I'm not much of a letter writer because, you know, sometimes a letter, like anything else, it's good to have for a file, but at the same time, I think people really appreciate if you just take the time out and actually get, you know, have a personal touch with them. So that's what I tried to do in most of my career, was to get, you know, have it a one-on-one And people appreciate that. But you know what I told you, I feel everybody's just the same as I am. I got to learn too. And that's one of the reasons, I believe in the hearing system we have. And you go home and people complain about something. I said, look, please do this for me from now on. If you know of some subject matter that is going to be heard, please show up. Because we don't know everything. As legislators, what we learn from you people. And if you show up at a legislative hearing, then of course, and then that gives us something to go on. So we can at least evaluate what your concerns are versus what maybe somebody else has. So it gave me a kind of a measuring stick.
Because your home was so far away, you obviously couldn't commute back and forth every day. Where did
no,
you?
No, we tried. I tried to get home every weekend.
Did you?
Because I had a kind of a district. It was a good district. I was on the freeway, and I was going through most of my district most of the time. And so you could probably see people that had a problem. You just stop by and see them on the way through. So that's the reason I hated the last reapportionment, because everything was just so diverse. You had if I come down on I-80, then you have to make a dog leg over into Sparks. It was just so terribly impractical. And that's the thing now, because my replacement comes from Sparks, and so he will not be able to represent Winnemucca and Battle Mountain like I have.
Where did you live in Carson during when you were here?
Well, for a while we used to rent, and then my accountant said, John, you're working your furniture, why don't you just buy a place? So we did. And he said, no, and it made good sense, because I had been a director of a bank, so I was down here a lot anyway in the interim. So we spent a lot of time in the Reno area or in this area, so it worked out well having a place. And fortunately, the last year has been great because of the illnesses my wife and I have had. All of our doctors are here, and this is a great hospital here in Carson City. So it's worked out to our advantage, from a selfish point of view.
Tell me about working with staff.
Dana, I want to say this. I have never known or been around people more qualified than the people we have in LCB. And that goes from the grounds people right on up to the director's office. These are the most professional, ethical people I've ever worked with. And they don't get politics in their way. They do their job, and they're very professional in what they do. I've had the opportunity of working with the fiscal people. I've been on the audit subcommittee since 1987. And of course, we do a lot of work with research, and that's of course where you were. And we've got great, great people. They're dedicated people. And people are just in this building, the legislative police. You can ask for more accommodating people. And the people in general in the LCB, I think, are a class people. I think some of them offer, but some I think probably have more to offer than some of the legislators do. You leave that in there, Joanna.
How did that change over, from the time when you first started to your last session? Did you see any kind of a change in how staff worked?
Oh, I think no. I think staff, they just keep improving with age as we go on. I think they just, as times change, this society gets more sophisticated. Our staff has the capability of keeping up with all the changes, all the technological changes, and our people are really up to snuff on just about every area. So I think the people of the state of Nevada should be proud of what the LCB does. All the divisions and right on up, you go by these grounds even. And I've had more people comment how beautiful just the grounds look. So that whole thing carries through to the work and what comes out, the product that LCB puts out.
Tell me some about interim committees. You've served on several.
Well, I've been on interim finance since the very beginning. And of course, that is kind of I've been questioned in the past whether or not it's constitutional, but we've gone all these years and never been challenged. And it's kind of a good way to know what's going on in the agencies. I keep track of them. And I've enjoyed the prison industries. I enjoy that very much because we're able to bring in new industries from time to time. And as I say, it's a money-making proposition, both I think spiritually and monetarily. And I think it does help rehab some of our people. And of course, I've been on the audit subcommittee, and that is next. And I probably learn more about how government operates by being on the audit subcommittee, because those people get in and dig up everything of how these agencies should work. And I've actually enjoyed that experience because I've learned more from how an agency works than I did just by being a legislator. because those people just put it out in front. They do just such an excellent job.
You served on the Public Lands Committee for a long time.
I've been on the Public Lands Committee since its inception. I've enjoyed it because, of course, having been president of the Cattlemen Association, and at one time I was on the advisory council to the old Public Land Law Review Commission, and I represented the cattle industry on that commission. Of course, we were there for 7 years. We traveled all over the United States, you know, kind of visiting all the public land areas and listening to everyone from miners to foresters to any category that had use on public lands. And it was a great experience. And of course, then the book came out, One Third of the Nation's Lands, and it wasn't quite the way I wanted it to come out. But unfortunately, I think at that time, the Congressman Aspinall let staff write the report rather than what the people testified, because I know they deviated quite a bit from what the mining industry had suggested. But it was a good experience, and of course it got me pretty well, you might say, founded in public land issues. And I'd been chairman of the Public Lands Committee for the Cattlemen Association most locally, and then I was vice chairman of the National Cattlemen. So I was involved in public lands for years. And of course then I'd spent 7 years as chairman of the Lander County Planning Commission, so you're always involved in land issues. And so it was a kind of natural to be on the Public Lands Committee. And of course, Dean Rhodes, I used him very extensively when I was president of the Cattlemen Association, because he was my public lands chairman. So we got him really involved. That's when Dean was kind of took hold, and it was kind of, you might say, one of the prime sponsors of the Sagebrush Rebellion. And so it was quite an experience. I think we saved the cattle industry and the livestock industry from being completely subjugated by the federal government. But we got enough attention from nationally that people realized that we did have a problem. But there for a while there was a terrible tendency, particularly in environmentalists, to put livestock people completely out of business.
Tell me a little bit more about the Sagebrush Rebellion.
Well, Sagebrush Rebellion, I tell you, when I was president, they had such stringent rules that they were promulgating that would have made it just practically impossible for people in the state of Nevada to have operated a cow outfit or even a sheep operation, because if it was based on slope, based on where the water was, it was just based on so many, you might say, extracurricular things that no way in the world you could have complied with. And it would just put everybody completely out of business. And so we got up, and I think we're very firm. I had a meeting when I was president. I had a meeting in Elko. I think we had 96% of all the ranchers in the state of Nevada showed up in Elko. And I tell you what, we weren't belligerent. We stayed our case, and there on we just kept going. And we finally got the attention of Congress, and so they were able to back off. And of course, one of the greatest things that ever happened to us when we got Ronald Reagan was elected, because Ronald Reagan understood the livestock problem. And so he was able to kind of turn the environments around a little bit. Of course, we had James Watt, who was Secretary of Interior at the time, and of course, he wasn't very popular with environmentalists, but at the same time, he was able to kind of keep us, you might say, rather healthy.
So you've mentioned the federal government a couple times in different aspects. What is the relationship between the federal government and the state legislature?
Well, I think anymore, probably when it comes to public land issues, that's where I've worked for most of the years. I think that we've kind of had an esprit de corps where we're getting along a lot better than we used to, because they kind of respect our position, we respect their position, and there's been some better appointees at the federal level that we've been able to work with. In Nevada, I've been very fortunate, like with the BLM, we've had some excellent state directors, and they've been good to work with, they understand the problems, and a lot of the directors we've had have actually, you know, come up through the ranks, so they know, you know, from the ground up what the problems are. So it's been a good relationship, but I realize, you know, that there's certain laws, and they got pressures from every group out there, and they have to kind of keep a balanced agenda, so you can't get everything you want, but what you do, you at least you try to come to some kind of a fair compromise.
Why don't we take a quick break here?
Yeah.
And see where we're at on the film and give you a chance to.
Rolling.
Most of your tenure, you were in the minority. But 1985, the Republicans took the assembly and you were chairing Ways and Means.
Right.
Tell me about that.
No, it was really quite an experience. It was. I had Bob Thomas, who was my vice chairman, and of course I had Marvin Sedway. And he was always having troubles with the people in the public, with the Public Works Committee. So a couple of times when he would get a little nasty, I'd have to recess the committee just to calm things down a little bit. But as I said, that was when I really got to know Jim Gibson, Senator Gibson, who was chairman of Senate Finance. And Jim and I used to, we worked very closely together. And he closed the budget 1 minute and I closed it the next, or vice versa. So there was never any conflict about what was going to happen one house or the other. The budgets always came out the same on either side. But I enjoyed the work. It takes a lot of work, you know, because you spend a lot of hours after hours, going over budgets, working with staff. But it was a good learning experience for me at that time, because you really learned how the agencies work, how they were financed, and I just thoroughly enjoyed it.
Did you think that at some point you might chair Ways and Means again?
Well, I was always kind of in a position to do it. And of course, then in 95, when we had the tie, then we split chair. And so Morris Arbery and I split. So he was chairman one day and I'd be chairman the next. So it was a good relationship. And of course, then we had good people over in fiscal. And as I say, they're non-political over there. And they give you the straight answers. They're not trying to bias anybody. They have no prejudices coming in. They tell you what they feel is arm's length. And so it's just a good type of relationship. And that's the way I like to legislate. And I realize, you know, a lot of times you have certain pet projects and you let maybe a little bias get in your way, but for the most part, you try to be fair.
How did things work with you and Mr. Arbery splitting the chairmanship that session?
Oh, real good, really good.
Did you two meet on a regular basis?
No, we actually had our offices real close together, and of course you had the people over there that worked. They worked together with both of us, and so there was good, excellent harmony. Just like Dan Hetrick and Joe Dean as co-speakers, they had an excellent relationship because they shared it every other day, and people just thought it worked out beautifully. So it was a good team, and they got along well. And of course, and Joe was an excellent speaker, as you know, and he understood the problems of all Nevada, and of course, coming from rural Nevada, he understood a lot of the rural problems. But he knows the state of Nevada, and I kind of hate to see Joe leave, because I thought he was really did an outstanding job.
And then in 1993, you were Assembly Minority Leader.
1993.
What does that mean?
Well, what happened? I won't name name, but there was a Las Vegas that was minority leader, and his own people from Las Vegas came up, and they weren't very happy with his performance. So I had seniority, and they said, John, you just got to take over. So I had no problem. So they more or less inducted me, you might say, as minority leader. And of course, in 95, I got to putting together my committees. Because that's kind of the responsibility of your minority and majority leaders. And no matter how I worked it, I kept coming out with a tie. So I called Marine Landing. I said, Marine, what do we do in case we have a tie? He said, you know, one time they used to flip a coin. I said, but they did away with that. So I told him, I said, I don't like that. Let's work on something else. So the thought about that for a good month. I finally decided, came up, because one of the other states had tried it. I said, let's just do this. Let's just split everything. And that was, of course, that was the ultimate solution. And it worked out real well.
So you mean you split the membership?
Everything was even. All committee assignments, we had equal numbers on every committee. We had the co-chair, we had the co-speakers. And it really was a great relationship. You know, you wouldn't have thought so, but it worked out real well because everybody got along.
Yeah, during the 95 session.
Right. It was a good session.
Yeah. Why were you minority leader only one session?
I was there twice, a couple of.
Well, twice?
I got out of it that time. Because I wanted Lynn Hetrick to be speaker. And so, otherwise, I'd have been speaker, and I didn't want to be speaker. So that took me out of the leadership, of that leadership. Because I thought Lynn would do a better job as speaker than I would have. And I wanted to be chairman of Ways and Means anyway, so that was the way I felt about it. I felt like since I'd been chairman of Ways and Means, I understood that, and I didn't really particularly care to be speaker. So it was just a matter of how I personally felt about it, but it worked out beautifully because Lynn was a good speaker too.
At one point in the Nevada legislature, there was the Cal County Caucus. Did that still exist?
Oh yeah, we still have it.
Really, it still exists?
No, it still exists. Yeah, and of course that's the thing that's going to be so sad this next session, because there's going to be one less. There won't be as many, but it's one way because we get a lot of lobbyists to sit in with us, get a lot of the people from the BLM, Department of Agriculture, Forest Service, they come and sit with us. And then you're able to kind of sit down and have a kind of one-on-one with these people, and then it's just a good way, kind of a sounding forum. And I really enjoyed the meetings, and an opportunity like for the various rural legislators to sound off to the other. You know, everybody's serving on different committees, and you kind of find out what's going on in other committees. But you know, being here every day, you just don't know what's going on in each and every committee. But this is one way you kind of keep yourself up to speed on what's going on in, say, in judiciary, what's going on in commerce, what's going on in education. So it gives you a pretty good background of what's happening in the session.
From the time that you started towards the end of your legislative career, were caucus meetings a fairly common thing in the beginning?
No, caucus meetings, you've always had caucus meetings. It's kind of one way. The thing I like about the caucus meetings, it's one way for the legislators to get to know one another. And then they can get up and speak their piece, and so you understand where they're coming from, that they're having trouble getting a bill passed or something, by bringing it up in the caucus. Then sometimes your caucus leaders can kind of go and maybe talk to the speaker or the powers that be and see if they can get a little help in pushing somebody's bill through, particularly if it's a bill of merit. You know, a lot of times you get some frivolous bills, and this is what I always tried to avoid, was the frivolousness, and just put, you know, something that had some merit to it. And that's where caucus is good. And, you know, then people are able to kind of vent their frustrations, or else they need to aim their positives of what they're getting done. And just, you know, and you keep that contact, and that's what you have to have. And of course, you know, then you kind of figure out your strategies. If you're going to have to, you know, sometimes when you're in a minority, I've been in a minority so much, but you got to know where to head them off with the past, you might say.
Well, since we're talking about caucuses, I have to ask you about 2003 and the Republican caucus and the tax fight that year.
Oh, I know. The thing about it, we had the, that was the thing that bothered me about the tax fight. It was one of the things, but then what really happened, Lynn and I tried to get to the three major bills in the tax bill, in Senate Bill 8. We had two very important, critical school bills, distributed school account and the class size reduction were in that one bill. And Lynn and I tried in our taxation committee to give them a divorce, but the Democrats wouldn't do it. And so finally we were just kind of at a loggerhead on the floor. But we needed that one more vote to get the majority. Because you know, that two-thirds, that super majority to get it out. Well, I was starting to get calls from a lot of the rural school districts, because they couldn't even open the schools, and it was in July. And some of the schools couldn't open because they didn't have any money to hire teachers. They couldn't sign contracts. So I told Lynn, I said, Lynn, I'll bite the bullet, and I'm gonna switch my vote. I'm gonna vote for it. We've got to get that bill out of here. It's not doing any good, it's not helping anybody. So I get charged now with being a tax, you know, spender. But my motive for that was get our schools open. My vote was for the kids, not for raising taxes. But you know, the other side of the coin was, I'm a director of a bank, and I had a very onerous section about banks in there. So I talked to the bankers that day, and I said, you know, I know it's not constitutional, you probably should say, well, we won't do it. But the bankers are treated quite differently than anybody else. They're paying twice as much on the payroll taxes as other industries. And so I said, I got their blessing to go ahead and vote for it. But my main reason was to get schools open. And of course, it was used against me during this last campaign. No, they go back that far, and they kept using it. And of course, that's the thing that happened to Bill Raggio in his primary. They kept using that against him. And the thing about it was for the good of Nevada. It was good for the school children of the state of Nevada. And you look at every Republican senator just about on the Senate side, except for a couple, voted for that for Senate Bill 8.
Oh, that was a
but it got me in the end, but you know, it happened. But I'm still pleased. But my own Republicans come up and hug you for doing it and say, thank you, John, for getting us out of here. Did that help? That ended the decision.
Well, that had to have been a tough decision to make.
Well, yeah, it was the right decision. You know, as far as I'm concerned, that's, you know, if you're going to be a statesman, be a good one. And I felt that was probably maybe the pinnacle of my statesmanship right there. If I was going to do something, let's do it right. But it turned around, it got me in the end, but at the same time, it was for the right reason.
Are there, in your memory, are there any other bills that rise to that level, some votes that you're particularly proud of or bills that you were particularly proud of?
Oh, you know, that offhand, Dennis, and so I've written so many of them over the years, but I can't think of anything with that much controversy. You know, probably the original tax shift. You know, people kept calling it the tax shaft, but it turned out, you know, it worked for a long time. I don't know. I'm not sure how we're going to be able to remedy it. And of course, you've got the governor now, and I don't know. And right now, psychologically, this next session, whether there's going to be appetite at all to raise taxes. We know we're in trouble, but at the same time, you know, you keep hearing the man in the street, Wall Street, and, well, you got to look at that man in the street, regardless, and it's what he can afford. And sometimes, you know, if business isn't doing well, if the common, you know, if we're having massive layoffs, it's not the time for the tax increase. I think you have to, you know, I just hate to keep doing this, but you have to go back and keep looking at that budget and see what it can still be lived without. So it's going to be a difficult session. And I sympathize and empathize with people that are going to be in the money committees this next session. It's not going to be easy.
And when you chaired Ways and Means, you were able to work on some things.
I had a lot of good things. One of the things I'm kind of proud of is the fact that I had a little trouble with the budget office at the time because, you know, I had a lot of these wheelchair people, you know, the people that were handicapped that wanted to didn't want to be institutionalized. Well, being an institution costs the state of Nevada a lot of money. So I was able to get money out so we could keep these people in their own private homes. And they'd have the care given to them, but we kept them out of institutions. You'd be surprised how many of those people came up and thanked me. One of the other things during that session was the fact I was able to get, you might say, what they call the AHEC program, and that is teaching nurses on the job to the School of Medicine, rather than have, we used ELK was our pilot project. And so we were able to video conference with the hospital in Elko from the School of Medicine and give nurses on-site training. So they were right there, say, in the operating room, and you had somebody supervising them from the School of Medicine. And the nurses were just so delighted with the program that we're using it every place now.
There were some other issues that you worked on.
Oh, we have, you know, systems. Just little things like, just from my nice little rural towns, like, say, Midas and Golconda and Tuscarora. When we had money, I was able to get water money for them so they could bring their water systems up to date. And, you know, I think it was a big help, particularly being in Midas, and where at one time their water wasn't very, you know, it was kind of, you might say, a luxury if your water ran. But they were able to, and you know, with the help of your dad, that they were able to get a decent water system now, and I think it's fairly adequate. At least they have water pressure, so they can fight fires.
Yep, they can do that. One of the other major shifts that happened when you were in the legislature was the shift to the 120 days.
Well, that, you know, that was kind of a compromise, I think, with Senator Raggio and the people that wanted every annual sessions. And so that's kind of what Senator Raggio came up with, was the 120 days and annual sessions. But the 120 days, though, sometimes I'm not, you know, because I've been here when we've gone a lot longer than that. Of course, the 120 days it may not even be realistic anymore because sometimes you just can't wrap it up in 120 days. And, you know, I realize you should get things done as quickly as possible, but at the same time, you know, we got that time restriction on you. But otherwise, you know, the option is to go to special sessions. So, and which we've done several times.
Well, when you think back on the unlimited sessions, How were they wrapped up? What was the process?
Well, I would, usually it was some little technical thing, like, well, one of the things was, you would say that's on the Bill 8, on the tax bill. That just kept us in gun until July, until we finally decided. What happened then, they kept changing every day. And that's the thing you had to worry about, is the fact that one day the House or the Assembly would change it, and the Senate would change it. Kept our fiscal people going nuts, trying to, you know, keep the, just trying to make, keep the money straightened out, how much each was going to bring in. So they didn't know where they were going to land either. So that's why I felt it was time to cut out the nonsense and get it over with.
When you think back on your legislative career, what are some of your fondest memories?
Oh, I think probably the people you meet. No, not so much what you might have accomplished yourself, but you make some very, very, I'd say, lifelong friends in both parties. And of course, so many great people to work with here on the staff, the LCB people. You know, I think I have some dear friends just throughout the whole system. They're just great people. That's been, probably been the highlight of my legislative career is the good people I've met and the friends I've made.
How did your legislative service affect your family?
Oh, actually, it worked out real well because, of course, when I entered the legislature, I was ranching, and I was always fortunate that I had good people on the ranch to run it in between. But, you know, I was home every weekend particularly, so and as long as you had competent help. And my son was who was an attorney in Elko. He was able to come down on weekends and kind of help, you know, kind of keep things straightened out. So it wasn't that, you know, I wasn't that large, so it, you know, wasn't an everyday thing for me to be there. As long as you laid out the work and I followed my budget, and so we made sure ends met. So, but it was just good to have something else to do besides just ranching.
When you ran in 1978, did you have any idea that you would still be running?
No, I redid. You know, there for a while. Well, that was the trouble. There for a long time, just too easy because I really didn't have much opposition for a long time. It wasn't until I got into Sparks that it really got bad because I didn't live there, and I wasn't about to move. You know, at my age, it was just it was just ludicrous to have to sell everything and buy a home in Sparks, Washington County, and I figured the sacrifice wasn't worth it. You know, I could give up this job and be just as happy.
Did you ever think about running for any other office?
And, you know, I never have.
Really?
I really haven't. Because there hadn't been anything I think I've ever wanted to be. Because no matter where you're going to go, you know, this has been rewarding enough. Because I've been in legislature, I do a lot of little things for a lot of people. And I think really probably the most gratifying part of your legislative experiences, which are new for people in between sessions. And particularly, you know, that's one of the advantages of being on the money committee is the fact that you know everybody, you know, in state government pretty well. And somebody has a problem, you know exactly who to call, and you call them up, and you can get a problem resolved in a matter of a few minutes. Where people, you know, they might write a letter, so they stall. But if you call them yourself, they'll listen to you, and then they'll try to take action. So I've had a lot of success that way.
When you think back on your years here, is there anything that you supported that you wished in hindsight you really hadn't gotten into that?
No, you know, I don't. And I'm not really sure I could, Dana. You know, as time goes on, probably if I probably had more time to think about it, I might be able to come up with it. But right offhand, I can't think of anything that I find really repulsive.
I want to take a little bit of advantage of our time and ask you a little bit about your grandmother. Tell me a little
bit
about Mrs.
James. Yeah, this is really interesting. I mean, my grandmother and my grandfather came from Wales. And my grandfather came over in the 1870s, and not too long after that, my grandmother, but he started out as a miner. And of course, where Core Rochester is right now, which has been a very successful silver mine, that's my grandfather started and didn't do very well.
And it was William Jenkins?
W.T. Jenkins. The Welsh name is Gwilym Treharn, that was the name, but Gwilym in English then is William. So it was W.T. Jenkins. So then he went and borrowed some money and bought sheep. And that's, we kind of started in Pershing County, and over the years just kept expanding and buying ranch after ranch, and and got pretty heavy in the cattle business. So the W.T. James Company then became probably about the third largest livestock operation in the state of Nevada. But getting back to my grandmother, I really, Dana, as much as I would like my mother, really was never too definitive about what her mother's wealth was. But apparently she came from a rather wealthy family in Wales, because and then my grandfather died when my mother, who incidentally was a twin, they weren't even a year old when her dad died. So my grandmother actually ran the operation until she remarried, and that was about 13 years later. But she must have been a lady, woman of means, because she was able to send my mother and her twin to Miss Amlin's boarding school in San Francisco. And so, you know, and I look back through some of the old records, and there was always money in those days, but I don't know why my mother, for some reason, was rather vague about what her wealth was. But I don't think we ever asked her. And of course, she passed away before I ever had an opportunity to get to the depth of it, but she must have been quite a lady. And of course, let's say she took over the helm of the largest sheep outfit, or the second largest sheep outfit in the state of Nevada at the time, and ran successfully until she died in 1918 from the flu. And then, of course, then by then, my mother and dad, my dad was stationed at the Presidio in San Francisco, met my mother, who was going to Miss Hamlin's. And of course, they were married, and after my grandmother died, then he resigned his commission. It was right after World War I, and moved to Battle Mountain, and I kind of took over the outfit. So that's kind of the history of where we start from with the James coming out, I've got going. But they bought out every stockholder. I don't know how many times we bought stockholders out, but we finally got everybody out over the course of years. Then we got to the point where estate taxes were getting pretty affordable. And our accountant said, well, you know, being an old operator, we were incorporated in 1901. They said, capital gains tax, something happened to you, or even a death, estate tax is going to kill you. So they talked us into selling the main outfit, which we did. And so it turned out better for everybody, because there were three brothers, and each of us had families. So everybody was able to quit his friends. But it turned out then, Willie and my wife and my dad and mother, we bought just a small ranch. And so that's when Willie and I kept it until 1991 and sold it.
So your grandmother was a livestock operator at the same time as John G. Taylor.
Oh, right. Matter of fact, it's kind of interesting. John G. Taylor one time wanted to marry her.
Really?
Yeah, that's the story my mother always talks about, that they said he always used to proposition her that they would be the sheep king and queen of the West if he would marry her. But she didn't want any part of John G. But he was, John G. Taylor himself was quite a dynamic guy.
Your grandmother must have been something to
She was quite a lady, there's no question about it. She, you know, she was a lady in the truest sense. But you look at some of the things that we've inherited over the years that my grandmother had. You know, she was a lady of taste and apparently of considerable means at one time. But I don't really know what the means might have been. There's nobody left in the family, I think, that really understand, that ever had a history of her. And I don't know how it could ever be traced. Maybe geologically some way. I don't know if computers would have that or not, but it'd be interesting to get into it sometime.
Yeah, that would be. A little off track.
Yeah, I know, but you know, my grandfather is buried in Wales.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Mm-hmm. And when he passed away, my grandmother had him sent to Wales.
And your grandmother died during the flu epidemic.
Yeah, in 1918.
That was quite devastating to Nevada.
Oh yeah, and had an aunt died then too. So there were two of my family that were caught up in the flu.
So what do you, getting back to your legislative experience, what do you think it is that back to your legislative service, do you think that there's something that Nevadans think about their legislature that isn't true, that perhaps?
Oh, I think, you know, you look at the average person, I don't think they really understand what goes on down here. And this is why I chastise them when they, you know, go home, they complain. I said, you know what you have to do, you know, this day and age, you can find out through the newspapers or through, you know, the website or wherever it is, what's going on in Carson City. And if you see some item of the particular interest, you get down there and testify up here. That's how we learn, and that's how you legislate, is if please tell us what, you know, what's bothering you, how you can improve on a bill, or no matter or how it affects you, and people will listen to you. Because I always said, you know, and that's one reason I'd march even my committee members when I was chairman, is you treat those people on the other side of the table just as like you were there yourself, because you never know when you might be there. So, you know, and it's worked out over the years too. But that's the thing I think basically, I'm stick my neck out. I think the average person is just ignorant of what we do down here. They don't really know what the legislature does. And now it might be a lot of our fault too that we don't really get out and tell people how it operates. You know, as I say, you go home, people, you catch it because something passed, and you say, well, where were you? So that's all I can say. I think the last election showed a lot too, that people don't really understand the political system.
We are getting close to wrapping up. When you think back on that first day when you walked in as a freshman assemblyman, and now to the end of your legislative career as the senior minority leader, and certainly the senior institutional memory on fiscal and tax issues, how has the legislature changed over that period of time? How has the institution?
You know, I think what's happened here, I don't think, you know, and I don't want to sound disparaging, but I don't think we have really the quality that we had at one time. But at one time, and you know, and it's not standing against people from out of state, but we had at one time pretty much of a, you might say, of a Nevada-type legislature. You had guys like Keith Ashworth and Jim Gibson, those kind of people, who were actually raised in rural Nevada. So they understood Nevada, and they understood the whole state. And this, I think, we kind of got away from it a little bit, is the fact that people are putting the whole state in perspective like they should. They're going more, I think, in the provincial type of legislating. If it affects their certain area, that's all they're really interested in. They're not interested in what's going to be good for the whole state. And this is what you're finding. And it's rather sad, because when I first came, I think everybody was here for the benefit of the whole state. And that's the way I still feel.
Well, thank you very much for your time this afternoon.
It's been a pleasure.
It has been a pleasure.
I always enjoy working with you, and certainly miss the days when you were with us on public lands.
Well, thank you so much.
And the many hours we put together, touring the streets of Washington, D.C., and
right.
the various little communities in Nevada.
That's right.
So.
Yep, those were fun times.
Yeah.
Well, thank you very much.
I've enjoyed your folks, too.
Yeah, it's been a pleasure.
Thank you.
Okay.
All right. Take care.